This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. As co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute, Hunter Lovins envisioned green business. She called it natural capitalism. In the year 2000, she was named a hero of the planet by Time magazine. Now Hunter Lovins has teamed up with Professor Boyd Cohen to present a new concept called climate capitalism. Is it possible for megacorporations and small business to become carbon friendly? In this speech recorded May 16th in Vancouver, Canada, Boyd Cohen says profits from energy savings, not concern for the climate, is what we should be talking about. Hold on to your sacred cows. Boyd Cohen says business can do it. Cohen was introduced by the Green Mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson. Boyd followed with this.
It's also a pleasure to be able to present this here in Vancouver, which is my hometown. I am American, but Canada is my adopted homeland now. I don't have any intention to go back to the States anytime soon. But I have brought some of my capitalistic tendencies from the U.S., just a different type of capitalism, hopefully, which is what we're here to talk about. I'm going to give you a bit of a whirlwind tour of the book in sort of 25-minute presentation. And as the mayor eloquently said, the basic argument is you can find ways to reduce your footprint and profit. And our focus for the book is on moving away from the discussion about does climate change exist. I suspect everyone in this room already knows that. Probably there aren't too many people in this room that want to have a drag-out fight on whether or not climate change exists or not. You'd kind of almost have to be from another planet to actually make that argument, given the facts about the last 10 years, hottest of the 11 ever recorded in history, glacier melt, all the rest of it. But we avoid that in the whole book on purpose. We feel that the climate change movement has failed the world because they are stuck in trying to prove science. Anybody who's read any science knows it's not like people say, do you believe in climate change? That's kind of a stupid thing to say, because belief is like, do you believe in God or do you believe in religion? Do you believe in Jesus Christ? It's not something you require a leap of faith for. It's not believing in something that's not real or that's not measurable or tangible. Climate change is real, but we've gotten bogged down in trying to make that argument. And we're losing the argument. So what if we change the argument? Who cares about climate change? We all do in this room, but just for a minute, who cares about climate change? Everyone cares about money. If I can show you a path to make more money, oh, by the way, you might actually make the world a better place too. Even if you're a greedy capitalist, you kind of like that because you can put it on your website for greenwashing or something. So the basic argument of the book is, who cares? Climate change doesn't matter. We're going to show you how to make money. You know, Al Gore did his thing with Inconvenient Truth. We got Rob Sofrato back here. He's an Al Gore ambassador. They can give you all the science about climate change. Imagine if billions could be made or saved by making a shift to a low-carbon economy. McKinsey Consulting, you know, those green tree-hugging company that does all the strategy consulting, they've done this research on climate change and abatement and mitigation of climate. And what they found is all these on the left-hand side are opportunities like fuel efficiency, lighting systems, air conditioning, water heating, fuel-efficient vehicles, biofuel. All these below the line, that's how they refer to it, below the line opportunities are all pure profit opportunities for companies. The Carbon Disclosure Project did research on the below the line McKinsey opportunities and determined that the average company doing reporting the Carbon Disclosure Project could generate about $30 to $40 million in extra revenue or diverted costs by executing these projects. Another real hippie company, Goldman Sachs, they did some research on the top 125 environmental, social, and governance companies in the world and tracked their share performance compared to the industry standard. 25% higher share performance from the 125 leading companies on environmental, social, and governance. Energy efficiency. Imagine if companies could save hundreds of millions by improving their efficiency. Because we're on the topic of tree huggers, I thought, you know, Walmart's the epitome of tree huggers, right? Not. But Walmart is one of the most advanced, forward-thinking companies today about how to profit from transitioning to the low-carbon economy. They anticipate saving $300 million a year from energy efficiency initiatives like in their transportation. They're doing some idling work on their trucks, and they're doing a lot of efficiency work in their facilities, both their stores themselves as well as their distribution centers. So for every chapter, I'm sort of giving you some little tidbits of examples. Many of them are in the book. And then I'm going to summarize with how many billions of dollars are going to be made in this sector. In energy efficiency, they're expecting about $60 billion by 2014 annually to be made from the sale of energy efficiency technology worldwide. Renewables. Imagine if entire cities and countries switch from fossil fuels to renewables at a profit. Probably a lot of you in this room have heard of Masdar, Abu Dhabi. They're one of the first cities to actually make a claim to be being built to be carbon neutral. They're going to be full-on renewables. They just came out with a proposal for 100 megawatts of wind power that they're working towards. Who'd have thought? Again, kind of contrary to what you'd assume, an Arab country with lots of oil is actually trying to be a carbon neutral, has a community that's going to be one of the most advanced thinking in carbon neutrality in the world. And they want to use this as a demonstration center and also a hub for the development of the next generation of renewable energy technology. Samsø Island in Denmark. We talk about them in the book. They're 100% off-grid. 100% of their energy is from wind power. 75% of their power comes from solar and biomass. And they have extra energy, so they sell it back to the mainland Denmark. Another example, closer to home, Bullfrog Power. They started in about 5 years ago. This is a wind park that they've been part of. Since they started 5 years ago, they have 8,000 residents and 1,300 businesses in six provinces that are part of the Bullfrog service. They're really promoting renewable energy adoption in Canada. Again, I mentioned that we would, after every sector of the economy, talk about the market opportunity. This is without wind and hydro, so this is other renewables, projected growth. There's an expected quadrupling revenue from 2006 to 2014 from renewable energy worldwide. Green buildings. What if buildings could generate more energy and water than they consume? They can. Some of you probably heard of the Living Building Challenge. This home actually was built in Victoria, so not far from here. Probably not surprising if you do it right. A home in British Columbia, we know we're still in May, and it feels like we're in January. It's raining all the time. They produce more water on site than they actually consume. So why we waste all this water? We can use it. It's about being smart with business and with our buildings and our cities. Again, big, big market. There's not a market I'm going to show you. There's like eight chapters in the book. There's not one that's not multi-billion already. Some of them are projected to be into the trillions. So you see today we're at 2010, green buildings, approximately $70 billion. This is U.S. alone. I was trying to find some data in Canada. I couldn't quite find it, but I know it's around. But we're a microcosm of the U.S. marketplace, and you can see the projected growth in revenues from buildings.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to Professor Boyd Cohen, co-author with Hunter Lovins of the new book, Climate Capitalism. For sustainable transportation, Cohen is talking about EVs, all-electric vehicles.
Transportation. Imagine an entire city or country could switch from gas to EV cars. Anybody heard of Shai Agassi in Better Place? World Economic Forum 2005, question was asked, how can we make the world a better place? Shai took the question to heart, named his company after it. I don't know if I would have named it that, by the way, but the company's pretty impressive. They've got activity in Australia, China, Denmark, Israel, Japan, and North America already, Hawaii and California. He recognized a flaw in the infrastructure that would help accelerate the growth of EV vehicles. That is this issue around batteries. If I buy an electric car only, how do I always charge it? How do I know I'm going to be able to charge it where I'm located, where I'm traveling? And what if the battery goes dead and I have to buy a new one and batteries are expensive? And he felt that was a big barrier to getting more accelerated growth of the market. So what he did was create a company to address that flaw in the market. Better Place basically creates the infrastructure in cities and countries around the world to essentially enable quick, fast changing and charging of electric vehicles. They have stations where you can drive up to them. You drive up, a robot computer basically comes in, sucks out your old battery and puts a new one in 4 minutes. So their goal was to do it in the same time or less that it takes you to fill up your car. A lot cleaner, you don't have to get out and get gas on your hands, and you just go in, swap out your battery, and leave. That company, he came up with that idea in 2007, he launched it. Generated $700 million in private capital investment in his first year. I don't know about my fellow entrepreneurs in here, but I've started a bunch of companies. I never got close to that, not even. Just recently, the company was valued at over $1 billion, $1.25 billion, started in 2007. EVs aren't the only solution in transportation. I mean, obviously, we can't get to everything in here in 20 minutes, but there's all kinds of cool transportation options. This is the high-speed rail proposed network in the U.S. Obama's not impressing too many people these days in our base, but he has been a little bit forward thinking about promoting the adoption of high-speed rail. $10 billion is going into that. And for any of you aspiring climate entrepreneurs in here, you don't have to design the locomotives. You don't have to design the system. In any new emerging business opportunity like this, there's all these ecosystems of services and products that are required to execute something like that. Software, consulting, land management practices. There's all kinds of stuff you can do to get involved in any one of these businesses. This is electric bikes taken off China. This is a Chinese manufacturer. They sell something like 700,000 of these a year. They're taking off in China. Here's Algae Fuel. Richard Branson, the guy behind the Carbon War Room and behind Virgin, is a big promoter of algae fuels. We've heard a lot of debate in North America about consumption of other types of like first-generation ethanol that are coming from food crops and the problems with that. But there are alternative bioenergy solutions. We have the head of the BC Bioenergy Network is sitting in the room. He could tell you quite a bit about what we're doing in BC around bioenergy. But there's a lot of non-food crop solutions to bioenergy and to alternative fuels. This is the Transmillennia. It's a rapid bus transit. It costs one-tenth of what it costs to build a metro line. And it gives you almost exactly the same value. It was initiated in Curitiba in Brazil, and now it's being adopted throughout the world, particularly in developing world, but it should be considered in other countries too. Got all kinds of cool features like dedicated lanes, just like a more rail transit might have. It's got a elevated platform. I've been on this in Bogota. You go down here, you pay when you get into here, and then you stand here when your bus comes, you step right onto the bus. There's not stepping up or anything else, so it's a super fast exchange. They have it integrated with bike systems and showers at some of the facilities, so it can be an integrated public transit system. They started this in 2006. 1.5 million daily users of that service in Bogota. It's only been started a few years ago. Brazil over here, as probably a lot of you know, Brazil's very advanced in the ethanol, and they've gone full-scale adoption of flex-fuel vehicles. Virtually 100% of every new vehicle sold in Brazil is a flex-fuel. That means it can accommodate biofuels, which we haven't gotten there yet here in North America. Agriculture, what if most of the food we ate was healthy and produced within 100 miles of where we lived? Another example very close to home. Bud, they didn't that long ago change their name. They used to be Small Potatoes Urban Delivery. They're now Sustainable Produce Urban Delivery. Their model has been so successful, they've replicated it. They started in Vancouver, and they went across a little bit east, and they went south of the border down the west coast. And they have some pretty audacious goals now. Go from $18 million revenue in 2010 to $100 million by 2015. I like to show this slide. This doesn't show the growth of the organics movement per se, which, by the way, went from around a $1 billion market in the 1990s to $25 billion a year just in the U.S. in 2010. But can anybody spot North America on this? Percentage of world's organic producers by geographic region. We got Africa, which we don't think about, but, of course, they're food supply didn't develop with chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, long transit, localized food production for obvious reasons. North America is a little dot on here. 1% of global organic production comes from North America. Carbon markets. I have a company. Actually, a few of my teammates are in the room. Elizabeth is my co-founder right here, and Pedro over there is our senior carbon analyst. What if hundreds of billions could be made by helping communities, small, medium-sized companies reduce their carbon footprint. We have several projects underway in Latin America particularly, and we're starting to do some work here in British Columbia. But here we have coal mine methane. We're doing a couple projects in Colombia on that. Coal mine methane, you probably know underground coal mines have a lot of methane. They explode. They kill lots of people. Coal mines in Colombia are very poor at managing methane. Anybody heard the term canary in a coal mine? You know where that comes from? coal mines send canaries down into coal mines to see if there's a lot of methane. If it dies, there's a lot of methane. If it sings, oh, okay, there's not a lot of methane. We don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but we believe they're still doing this in Colombia. This practice has been outdated for like 60 years in the rest of the world. But the point is they have such bad methane management practices, they have all these explosions. A lot of people die. We have two clients, one that had 73 people die in June of last year, and another one had 21, 22 people die this year already from these explosions. So there's all these reasons why they need to get their mind around it. Well, methane, we can turn this into a climate capitalism opportunity. Rather than this problem that kills your labor force and wreaks havoc on your production, obviously, you can turn it around. You can capture the methane, which they normally vent into the atmosphere. Probably most of you know methane is a terrible greenhouse gas, 21 times more potent than CO2. So we can capture that methane and then use it on site as like a green gas energy source, something actually Bullfrog's using green gas now, mostly from landfills. Use it as a green gas for on-site production. There's coal mines in China that are making more money from selling the energy associated with the gas content from their coal mines than they're actually making from selling coal. That's how much opportunity there is. It's just wasted. They're sending it right up into the atmosphere. So it's just creating global warming and no value add. There's other benefits too, like it increases their efficiency of production. Over here, you see Pedro. He was managing our project in Brazil, which is an efficiency project in brick making in Brazil. In the northern part of Brazil, they typically deforest the Amazon for burning in their kilns to make bricks. They use Amazonian wood for all kinds of things, but in this project, we're attacking this specific problem. And you'll see some key statistics on here, again, making the business case for climate protection. When we ask the brick makers, you know, what are your top three concerns, I can promise you their greenhouse gas emissions aren't on the top three or top ten. But things like how much energy they're consuming to make bricks, that's something they're worried about because that directly affects their profitability. What if I can go to one of those brick makers and tell them I can help them achieve a 60% increase in their efficiency of their production and give them a rapid payback? And on top of that, by the way, you're going to get this extra money from carbon offsets, which is what we do. So the carbon becomes an additional revenue stream. But this is actually something we had to learn because we started our company focusing on we can help you reduce your emissions and sell the offsets in the market. But they don't care about emissions and offsets. That's not their core business. They care about their business. Their business is making bricks for as much money as they can for the least cost they can. So we changed our marketing approach. We're going to help you optimize your business for efficiency and maximize your profitability. And oh, by the way, you're going to be a good climate citizen. That's kind of the point of the book, too. Carbon markets. In North America, we have this view that carbon markets suck. They're terrible. They're not functioning. Nobody's making money off them. They're a failure. But you know what? They're not. Anywhere where they're actually operating a carbon market, we're not. Like Europe, where they've been operating for several years, you see a pattern here. It's going up. $140 billion a year in revenues as of last year in carbon in the European market. It's called the Clean Development Mechanism. That's where we operate. This phase two thing is a big, giant elephant in the room. Big, giant one. The reason is that's post-2012. Most of you probably have heard we have this big issue. We had Copenhagen where it was like Copenhagen, and it turned out to be absolute disaster. Cancun was a little better, but basically we can't get the whole world to agree on emission targets. And it's a big problem. But Europe is still plugging along. They had an 8% reduction target by 2012. They're between 20 and 30% by 2020. So they're still going to be reducing their emissions, and they're still going to be buying offsets, and it's going to go up. And here we have pockets in North America, too. We have the WCI, the Western Climate Initiative. Here in BC, we have the government's own commitment to carbon neutrality. All right, so this gets us in trouble, Hunter and I, sometimes in some environmental rooms. I don't think we have too many hardcore environmentalists in this room. People don't like that. We're talking about adaptation. Climate change adaptation is the point about what do we do for communities that are facing challenges associated with climate change already. The reason why this gets us in trouble is because a lot of environmentalists think we're copping out, and instead of trying to convince engineers and private capital to go all in to mitigating, we're starting to get people to throw up their hands in the air and say, well, we're not going to stop climate change. We might as well just try to make life a little more bearable. But the thing is, there are communities all around the world that are struggling right now because of climate change. We can't just like close our eyes and forget them because we're still focused on mitigation. We got to work on adaptation. And one of the things I'm really enjoying lately is focusing on the conservatives. There are very few of them in North America, but conservatives, Republicans that actually have figured this out, that things like adaptation and mitigation are so important. And if we don't get our act together now, the costs later are going to be way worse. There's a study that just came out called Pay Now, Pay Later, American Security Project. Look it up. Very interesting. Bipartisan, but has a strong Republican angle to it.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock with Professor Boyd Cohen on his new book, Climate Capitalism, co-authored with Hunter Lovins. Boyd argues we must start adapting to a new climate because it is already here with these examples.
Russia, 2010, heat wave, $15 billion lost to the economy, 5,000 people died. Pakistan, floods, several millions of people displaced. Hurricane Katrina, a million people displaced, something like $80 billion of cost to the economy. Bolivia, disappearing glacier melt. This glacier they used to ski on, by the way, they projected was going to disappear by 2015, disappeared in like 2008. We're accelerating our pace of climate change. And therefore, let me go back to this for a second. You say, so what, a glacier in the middle of nowhere in Bolivia. That glacier melt was one of the primary sources of drinking water for the city of La Paz. La Paz has over a million people living near La Paz. In our chapter on adaptation, we talk about water, water, water. Water is like a huge, huge issue, and it's going to stay that way. Again, the point of the book is where are the business opportunities around this? So helping people address lack of water, we have a billion people in the world that don't have regular access to quality potable drinking water, and it's going to get worse from climate change. FogQuest is a Canadian nonprofit. They created the system of netting that basically captures fog and clouds as it passes by and takes the liquid, converts it into it is potable water already, and they transport it in these jugs or in other piping to nearby communities. You think, well, that's not enough water, but not everyone in the world takes 20-minute showers and waters their lawn with potable water like we do in North America, so water can last longer in other countries. This is a cool technology from Sweden that is called Solvatten, and they've turned these into carbon projects, by the way. But these little canisters are solar-powered. They can be refilled three times and produce enough for a family to serve their water needs for a whole day, a large family. It's off-grid solar. It's solar with a filter that converts dirty water. You can put very dirty water in there, and out comes clean drinking water. And then this is the other side of the water problem. Mostly we're talking about not enough water for agriculture, for consumption, whatever. But here's too much water. Barrier systems, technologies, warning systems, all the kinds of things we need. We're seeing it right now. I mean, I don't even have to use any examples from last year. I can talk about anything happening today, and we've got examples, right? Look what's happening in the U.S. right now in Tennessee with the flooding, the river flooding. So barrier technologies, as we're going to see more and more of this, we've got to keep mitigating. But we got to help people adapt, and there's money in helping people adapt. Here's the projected cost all the way to 2100. I didn't make this up. The NRDC did with a lot of research. They took four sample categories of projected losses, business as usual, due to climate change over time, and you're seeing a whole lot of money, a lot of cost to the global economy if we can't start mitigating. And while we're at it, we got to start adapting. So I know probably not that many of you in this room, but I can tell you Hunter and I have spoken to rooms where they're thinking this question a lot. Isn't capitalism the whole freaking problem? Why would you call it climate capitalism? Why not call it climate socialism? I'll tell you why. I think climate capitalism coupled with courageous politicians and demanding consumers is the only path to economic prosperity. We spent a lot of time in Bolivia. We were actually trying to do carbon projects there, and you probably know Bolivia and Venezuela, where Elizabeth's from. Very socialist countries, very anti-capitalist countries. Bolivia particularly has a very strong understanding of climate change because of like what I just showed you, the glacier melt, their leader actually really gets climate change. Evo Morales understands climate change, but boy, does he got it wrong. He's all anti-market. He doesn't believe in carbon markets, doesn't believe in companies. He thinks the only solution is to convince the northern countries of the world who are the big problems associated with climate change to just pay them lots of money to adapt. They don't think they have to mitigate, and they don't want to support companies mitigating. It's a wrong strategy, and it's not going to work. If you go to climatecapitalism.org, which is where we're promoting our book, you can see a sneak preview of the post. But I highlighted 10 politicians around the world. We've got heads of state like Merkel and Cameron, conservative heads of states, by the way, that actually get this. Daley, he just left office on Friday, but he was in office for 20-some years as mayor of Chicago. So think we're alone as business leaders seeing climate change as an opportunity. Think again. I did this post a month ago on Corporate Knights and on Triple Pundit. You'll recognize some of those faces. Kosla, running a $1 billion clean tech fund in the Valley. Ray Anderson, Foster, who's behind the Masdar project. World's first solar billionaire, Van Jones, he's promoting the green economy. Richard Branson, Shai Agassi, we already talked about him. Al Gore's very controversial, of course, but I would put him in a climate capitalist role. Beyond him, Carbon Disclosure Project. We went from 200 companies in 2003 to over 3,000 large companies around the world that are voluntarily disclosing their carbon emissions and working to reduce them. These three companies have a couple things in common. All three of them are members of the Carbon Disclosure Project. They're reporting. There's something else they all have in common. They all walked out of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. All of them. They all publicly ridiculed and slammed the Chamber of Commerce. Why? Because the Chamber of Commerce, claiming they represent the business interests of their constituents, i.e. all of the businesses in the United States, are lobbying against climate legislation. Nike, Apple, Johnson & Johnson, companies we all know, they all publicly ridiculed the Chamber of Commerce because they said they're backwards. We've got to get this figured out because the costs, if we don't, are going to be way worse. And by the way, we can do this at a profit, i.e. climate capitalism. So you could change your light bulbs or turn off your lights for Earth Hour, but how are you really going to move the needle? We're hoping that we don't sit around too long waiting for that part of the formula to find its way into reality. Here's how I would summarize it. If you don't do it for the Earth because you don't care about the Earth, it's, well, we can throw it out. We'll get another one. Who knows? We'll figure something out. We can move to the moon. If you don't do it for your children, that's mine right there. The point is, if you don't do it for the Earth, you don't do it for your kids, then for God's sake, just do it for the money. Thanks.
You have just heard Professor Boyd Cohen speaking in Vancouver, Canada on May 16, 2011. The talk was sponsored by Discovery Parks, Vancouver Green Tech Exchange, and CO2 Impact, and introduced by the Mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson. It was the launch of a new book, Climate Capitalism, from New Society Publishers. Cohen, an American now teaching at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, co-authored the book with Hunter Lovins, the famous founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. Lovins began the nonprofit organization seeking sustainability called Natural Capitalism. Now, in the real world of business, large and small, these teaching entrepreneurs promote climate capitalism to cut emissions. It's a different approach to climate change. Find out more at climatecapitalism.org. This recording is by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Download a free MP3 of this talk from the climate change page of our audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org. Thank you for caring about your world.